We are podcasting from inside the archive room. Welcome to the Year 12 English Podcast. In this podcast episode, we're going to be looking at The Seven Stages of Grieving, which is a play written by Wesley Enoch and Deborah Mailman. And this episode will include both a reading of the play and also some analysis and commentary as we go. It is important to remember that this is a play script, so unlike a novel, there are stage directions and other aspects of the play that need to be taken into consideration. So it's important to be following along in a printed copy to understand all that is being said. In one of the introductory articles in the published edition of Seven Stages of Grieving, it talks about the background to the title of this story. On page 15 of that edition, it says, "The Seven Stages of Grieving comes from a paralleling of the Five Stages of Dying by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and the Seven Phases of Aboriginal History. It seemed that there were similarities, and this began an exploration into the personal and political history of Indigenous Australia as an expression of our grieving. The performance follows the experiences of an Indigenous every woman, chronicling the grief present in her life and the means of expressing it. Though the stories acknowledge real events, family histories and personal experiences of the collaborators, The Seven Stages of Grieving is ultimately a work of faction, a mixture of fact and fiction. As our lives and histories reflect the political changes and policies of the past 207 years, every Murri has a family story of being taken away or forced denial of language or strict protectionist practices. So it can be said that our personal histories are indeed the history of our political relationship to migrant Australia, one of grief, misunderstanding and injustice. This performance draws upon both traditional and contemporary arts and cultural practice. The integration of art forms, the use of storytelling techniques, new song and dance, and the cultural issues surrounding mourning are brought together with projection technologies, contemporary performance art, and modern theatrics to explore a form of cultural hybridity. The Seven Stages of Grieving has been based on the concept of drawing influence from our heritage as Murri artists and the current artistic milieu with all it has to offer to this culturally specific exploration of our voice. The Seven Stages of Grieving has been developed for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander audiences, acknowledging a sense of recognition and shared history. We cry together, we laugh together, and we tell our stories." The play begins with the prologue, and the stage instructions for this are: a large block of ice is suspended by seven strong ropes. It is melting, dripping onto a freshly turned grave of red earth. The performance area is covered in a thin layer of black powder, framed by a scrape of white. Within the space, there are projection surfaces. A voiceover then begins. "Ladies and gentlemen, we would like to take this opportunity to warn members of the audience that the following performance contains names and visual representations of people recently dead, which may be distressing to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. All care has been taken to acquire the appropriate permission and to show all proper respect. Thank you." So with this prologue scene, I think there are a couple of things that are important to look at. One is the symbol of ice. And that sort of one of the things you need to remember with a play is that it is very visual. It is designed to be watched and seen. So it's not just the words that we need to look at here, but what we would be seeing if we were an audience watching this play. So that grave of red earth, that newly dug grave that is in the center of the performance space, and then this block of ice that's sort of melting and dripping into it are important things. Obviously, we have the acknowledgement at the start of this play, which is now quite common in Australia, but it's important to remember that that wasn't something that was always common. We didn't often acknowledge Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people or give appropriate warnings when images of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who had passed away were being shown. So we'll come to that a little bit later on in the play, but it's important just to recognise why that is here in the prologue. The next scene is called Sobbing. The stage direction says, "The faint sound of someone crying in the dark. The sobbing drowns into a wail as the light reveals an Aboriginal woman alone with her grief. As her weeping subsides, words are projected up onto the screen. Grief, grieving, sorrow, loss, death, pain, distress, lament, mourn, emptiness, despair, lonely, regret, misfortune, guilt, passion, love, absence, desolate, nothing, nothing, I feel nothing." So one of the really interesting things about this scene, other than just the power of having these words projected onto a screen and without any voice, so even though I have read them to you in a performance aspect, these would just be seen on the screen. So it's the audience watching these appear in front of them in silence and really giving the audience a chance to reflect on what these words mean. A number of these words are synonyms, so they are different words but with similar meanings. And I think there is also these list of words suggests a representation of Indigenous history since colonisation. So if we think about what we know about Indigenous history in Australia, it has been a history of grief and grieving and sorrow and loss and death, etc. So really important that we focus on each one of these words and understand what they mean in the context of Indigenous history. The next scene is entitled Purification. And the stage directions say, "The woman lights up a wad of eucalyptus leaves and watches them burn. She blows out the flame, and as the embers smoke, she sings a song for the spirits of those that have gone before her and asks permission to tell the story of her grief. Muraba Buladu, Yugala Yugala Munangi, Yugala Yugala Munangi, Buladu Buladu, Muraba Buladu, Buladu Buladu, Muraba Buladu, Buladu Buladu, Muraba Buladu, Yugala Yugala Munangi, Yugala Yugala Munangi." So I think there are a couple of things that are important to consider here. One is that the stage direction and what the one woman actor here is doing is she's going through that ceremony of burning the eucalyptus leaves, and we know that the smoking ceremonies in many Indigenous cultures, including Australian Indigenous culture, is a sign of purification. And it's the stage directions tell us that she's asking permission to tell the story. So again, that idea that stories belong to the people whose stories they were, and that if we're telling other people's stories, we need to ask permission to do so. The other thing that I think is really important to consider here for this scene is why this scene is in an Indigenous language. I don't profess to have any knowledge whatsoever of Indigenous language, so I've done the best I can here, and we will talk about the translation of this, but I think there is something quite powerful for an audience about hearing this in Indigenous language rather than just in English. The next scene is called Nana's Story, and the stage directions say, "The performing area is flooded with colour. Floral patterns cover the woman's dress. The story is textured with sounds of family, country music, and the call of the kingfisher. The only thing black at a funeral should be the colour of your skin, and so all my young cousins wore bright floral dresses. My grandmother was a strong, God-fearing woman who at the age of 62 was taken from us. Moved on, passed away. My family were in mourning for a month, all of us together in five houses. We numbered close to 50 people. My grandmother didn't want to go to the hospital because that's where people went to die. Most of her friends had never come back. She was a woman who couldn't trust doctors, a woman who couldn't speak to teachers or police, wouldn't answer the telephone, gave her tithe to the church and got nervous at the mention of the government. The whole family came together for meals, huge barbecues, bowls of salads laid out on makeshift trestle tables, tropical fruits, bread, pasta, rice. No matter what you were having for dinner, there was always rice, stew, rice, steak and chips, rice, sandwiches, rice, hot rice, cold rice, in between rice. Spoke so much steak and sausages and mince and chicken, stuff we had spent half the day cooking or pots of things other family had brought over. Nana would tell us of the days where there wasn't enough to feed all the kids. She would tell us a lot of stories, but when she wouldn't tell us a lot of stories, but when she did, we all listened. She'd sing to us. The sound of country music mixing with the clicker-clack of knives and forks, and then someone would start singing along. Before you knew it, the older generation were in the middle of Delta Dawn, and us lot all cringed. Even to this day, I can still sing all the words, but I won't. There was so much going on. Sometimes you didn't notice two people hugging, sobbing in the hallway. Everyone had their time. Sometimes you feel like crying, and sometimes the joy of being there was enough to forget, even for the briefest moment, the reason. My sister reckons that she knew about Nan first. In the middle of the night, the sound of a bird singing had woken her up. She went to the kitchen, she made a pot of tea, she sat beside the phone and waited. When it finally rang, she answered, "I know." 400 people. 400 people turned up to the service. They couldn't fit in the church. They just sat in the shade, listening from outside. But when we got to the grave, a song caught on around the gathering, the old aunties, the uncles, until they were all singing. The words were unfamiliar to me. The tune soared above us all with the Kingfisher. Back at the house, the boys painted up and danced, and the girls showed a thing or two as well. The neighbours watched from the safety of their kitchen windows. One fella came out to water his garden, gaming-like. Another had his video camera, and we talked and drank and laughed. The kids got a video, but when it came to sleeping, oh shit, cushions, mattresses, lounges, the back seats in cars, black fellas as far as the eye could see. I miss my grandmother. She took so many stories with her to the grave. Stories of her life, our traditions, our heritage, who I am, gone. So I think there are a couple of things in this scene that are interesting to reflect on. One is this idea of remembering and forgetting, and what happens when people pass away? You know, what happens when a generation is gone, and what is lost along with that generation, stories that only they knew, things that were significant to that family or that area or that culture that can potentially be lost forever. The next scene is called Photograph Story, and the stage directions say, a chair scrapes across a wooden floor, footsteps recede, a clock ticks. Projected are images of an open suitcase filled with family photographs, old and new. The progression of slides brings us closer into the details of the photographs. In the house of my parents where I grew up, there's a suitcase which lives under the old stereo in the front room. The room is full of photographs, trophies, pennants, memories of weddings, birthdays, christenings and family visits, a testimony to good times, a constant reminder. But this suitcase, which resides under the old stereo tightly fastened, which lies flat on the floor, comfortably out of reach, safe from inquisitive hands or an accidental glance. In this suitcase lies the photos of those who are dead, the nameless ones, and here they lie, passing the time till they can be talked of again. Without a word, we remove the photo of my Nana from her commanding position on the wall and quietly slip her beneath the walnut finish, and without a sound, push her into the shadow. Everything has its time. Everything has its time. So I think there are a couple of things in this scene that are important. One is obviously the significance in Indigenous spirituality of images or representations of people after they've passed away. So you will often hear, as you did at the start of this play, you'll hear it on the news, you'll hear it in the radio. If they are showing a picture or a recording of the voice of someone who has passed away, they will always give a warning to Indigenous listeners that that is going to happen, because for Indigenous people it is quite disrespectful to look at an image, at a picture of someone who has passed away. And here we have this really strong image of a suitcase, and I'm sure we can all picture it in our heads, of an old suitcase, where once someone passes away in this family, their pictures are taken down and put into this suitcase. And it's almost like another type of grave, a grave for these images. And they become nameless, so they're not spoken of again. And that's not because people want to forget them, but because they are showing them the ultimate respect. The next scene is called Story of a Father, and the stage direction says, the woman sits on the edge of the grave. I'm trying to deal with Dad's death. He He hasn't died yet, but the time is coming soon when he'll be taken away. He's 48, in and out of hospital. He knows he needs to rest, but he hasn't stopped fighting since 1967. I know it seems selfish that the thought is on myself rather than Dad, I know, but the time is coming when this won't be a rehearsal anymore. Sometimes I find myself crying in the dark alone. The pain comes in and I cry and cry until I can't feel anymore, numbed, nothing. But I've got my home and I've got my family and I'll never have to live through what my dad lived through. It's inevitable, death. The one thing that I find comforting about it is that everyone's got to do it. Philip Ruddock, Bruce Ruxton, John Laws, Alan Jones, Stan Zemanek, Pauline Hanson, David Oldfield, Cheryl Kerner, just for being stupid. So there are a lot of references, obviously, to political and public figures in this. I think one of the things that's really interesting in this scene is this observation that this woman, she says, I will never have to live through what my dad lived through. And that suggests that there is this generational change, that each generation faces new challenges, different challenges, and some of the challenges are only ever faced by one generation. And then that can be talked about and you can try and understand it in the next generation, but you can never quite understand what that means. So if we think about an analogy there, you know, here in 2021, we can think about what happened during World War One and Two. We can read stories about it. We can watch documentaries. We can even speak to the few survivors that are left of World War Two. But we can never really understand what it was like to live through that period of history because that hasn't happened to us. So similarly, this woman is saying that she is not going to have to deal with the same things that her father dealt with. But the implication there is that there are new challenges for her. She also talks about or references a range of people, and all of these people, if you do some research, you will find that they've all had quite derogatory and inflammatory things to say about Indigenous people. So she is taking some comfort in the fact that, you know, even these people who were just being stupid will also ultimately die. The next scene is called Front and Centre. I went to a funeral the other week. A young fella had died, no family really, by himself. But in the front row, front and centre, I noticed this old auntie crying, that heavy wailing cry. Now I knew she couldn't have known this fella, he had no family to speak of. And at the end of the service, she just slipped out without talking to anyone. It was playing on my own mind, I decided to follow her, see where she went. She didn't live far from the church, just around the corner in a flat under someone's house. It didn't faze her when I knocked, she welcomed me straight in. The first thing I noticed were the five cats she had, and then the newspapers, piles and piles. And on the dining table, at first I thought the table was full of form guides for the horses, pages with bright blue circles. But when I got closer, I could see there were pages of death notices. And the things she'd circled were today's funerals. I could see she spends her day going from church to church, going to funerals. She didn't bat an eyelid when I asked her why. I might be related, she answered. I never knew my family. Maybe I could meet my real family. And if not, I get to have a good cry anyway. The woman leaves. There's something quite confronting, I think, about this scene, even though it's very simple. And it references a lot of things that have happened in Indigenous history. Obviously, talking about the stolen generation. So you have an old woman here who doesn't know her family. Obviously, she was taken from her birth family. She didn't grow up knowing them. She has no connection with them. So for her, her whole purpose in life is to go to funerals in this probably unrealistic hope that she will actually meet some of her family. And she says that even if she's not going to, she's going to have a good cry. So, you know, that sense of this grief for people who have been part of the stolen generation, who have been displaced, who don't have that sense of belonging, that grief is there every day and in every second. And even if all she is able to do on that day is have a good cry, that's at least bringing her some level of comfort. The next scene in the play is called Family Gallery, and it's a silent scene. So there's actually no spoken words here. It's just the following stage directions. A collection of family photos are projected like portraits in a gallery. They are recognisable as images from the suitcase. The next scene is called Black Skin Girl, and the stage directions say, the woman dances around childlike. singing. Letters of the alphabet appear on her dress. At first it's a game, but one from which she tires. She attempts to evade the letters by removing her dress. She is left topless with the letter Z on her chest. Bully Yuli Me, Bully Yuli Me, Bully Yuli Me, Nai Gigi Warangudu, Nai Giri Warangulu. So again, I think with this scene, it's really important to particularly look at the stage direction. So, you know, this idea that, you know, there are letters of the alphabet, obviously the English alphabet, so our spoken letters, that are being sort of removed. She's sort of trying to distance herself from language that is unfamiliar to her. And again, we have this character speaking in an indigenous language. The next scene is called Invasion Poem, and the stage directions say, a shaft of light from a half-open door frames the woman. A chair scrapes across a wooden floor. Footsteps recede. A door closes. A clock ticks. They come in the front door, smiling, offering gifts. I invited them in. They demanded respect. They sat in my father's seat and talked to me of things that made no sense. I nodded, listened, gave them my ear as I was always taught to. Without warning, they broke from our soft, whispered conversation. One took a handful of my hair and led my head to their knee. Another washed his face in my blood. Together they chained my feet, my feet. My children, stolen away to a safe place, were wrenched from familiar arms and forced to feed upon another tongue. The protest of my mother's mother cut short, silenced by a single wave of a stick, told not to speak, not to dance, told not to do what we have always done. I lie painfully sleepless in a landscape of things I know are sacred, watching unsympathetic wanderings. To wander is to think. To wander is to walk. The woman retrieves her dress. So this is a pretty powerful poem, and it's this Indigenous woman reflecting on what happened when the first fleet arrived in Australia, and she sort of talks about them being like a visitor, that initially, you know, they were invited in, they were shown respect, they were, you know, there was that attempt to sort of engage with them, but then that relationship turned and, you know, the women were abused, they were chained, children were stolen, they were forced to feed upon another tongue, so to learn another language. Generations were cut short, they were punished with a stick, they were told not to speak, not to dance, not to do anything, any of the things that were important in their culture. And then she talks about a landscape that is sacred, and that people are wandering that landscape in an unsympathetic way, not actually understanding how sacred that landscape is. The next scene is called 1788, and the stage directions say that the date 1788 appears. Oi, hey you, don't you be waving back at me. Yeah, you with that hat. You can't park here, eh? You're taking up the whole bloody harbour. Just get in your boat and go. Go on, go on, get. So even though this is a very short scene, and it obviously is partnered with the previous scene, which is the invasion poem, but here you have this woman speaking as if to the first fleet and telling them, you know, hey, you know, don't just wave back at me. You can't park your boat here. You know, you're taking up the whole harbour. So you're speaking in a very modern way, but obviously addressing that back to the first fleet that arrived in 1788. The next scene is called Murray Gets a Dress, and the stage directions say, delivered in the style of stand-up comedy. Have you ever been black? You know, when you wake up one morning and you're black. Happened to me this morning. I was in the bathroom looking in the mirror. Hey, nice hair, beautiful black skin, white shiny teeth. I'm black! You get a lot of attention, special treatment when you're black. I'm in this expensive shop and there's this guy next to me, nice hair, nice tie, nice suit, waving a nice big pump you full of holes semi-automatic gun in the air, and the shop assistants are all looking at me. Keep an eye on the black one, eye on the black one. Okay, so I went to try on a dress and the shop assistant escorts me to the special dressing room, the one equipped with video cameras, warning to shoplifters, a security guard, fucking sniffer dog, get out of it. Just so I don't put anything I shouldn't on my nice dress, nice hair, beautiful black skin and white shiny teeth. Now I'm in this crowded elevator, bathed in perfume, in my nice dress, nice hair, beautiful black skin and white shiny teeth. Hey, which way? The woman sniffs the air. Someone bodgy and they all look at me. Ah, knock off. Now I go to my deadly Datsun, looking pretty deadly myself. Which way? Lock my keys in the car, eh? But this Maury's too good. She got a coat hanger in her bag. Fiddling around for a good 5 seconds and started hearing sirens. Look around, policemen on bikes, policemen in cars, policemen jumping out of helicopters, and that same fucking sniffer dog. Get out of it. It's my car. So I'm driving along in my car. Car breaks down. Get out, start waving. People for help. Vroom. Imitating a fast car. Waving for help. Vroom. Help. Vroom. Finally get home. Foot falcon job. And I'm still looking deadly in my nice dress, nice hair, beautiful black skin and white shiny teeth. Auntie comes in. Hey, sis girl, you bought a new dress. Too bad it makes you look fat. I go to bed thinking, tomorrow will be a better day. Snuggling up to my doona and my pillow. Morning comes. I wake up. I go into the bathroom. I look in the mirror. Hey, nice hair, beautiful black skin, white shiny teeth. I'm still black and deadly. So this is an interesting scene that really, quite confrontingly, I think, addresses the way other people see Indigenous people. So it really addresses a lot of those stereotypes that, you know, even if there's someone waving a machine gun around in a shop, you're going to be looking at the Indigenous person because they're the ones that you're scared is going to steal something. She's trying to get into her own car and, you know, police turn up because they think she's going to rob it. You know, nobody stops to give her a lift when her car has broken down. So there's also this sense of her looking at herself in the mirror and that realization that comes each morning that she is black, that she's Indigenous. But with that comes all of this treatment and mistreatment that is going to happen just because the color of her skin. The next scene is called Auntie Grace, and the stage directions say the woman pulls the suitcase out of the grave, placing it before her on the floor. She opens it. She looks up at the audience. Auntie Grace came back especially for Nana's funeral. I'd only known this woman through Nana's collection of photographs. They were never displayed with the other members of our family. They were only brought out on request when any of the older cousins asked about family history. The pictures always showed the two sisters together going to a social or party. Auntie Grace was beautiful, a half head taller than her younger sister, slender and almost inevitably dressed in white, teeth glowing extra white in the two-tone capture of the moment. My father went to pick up Auntie Grace from the airport and dropped her at a hotel. She wasn't going to stay with the rest of us. That was very clear. Auntie Grace lives in London. She's lived there for almost 50 years. I'd never met her, though I'm told I had when I was a baby. No one really talked of her, but she seemed to know all about us, remembering names and quoting our parents' names and guessing ages. Her features well-preserved, her skin gone pale for a want of sun, and though she looked like no one in particular from the family, she fit into the look of us all. The skinny ankles, the line of her shoulders, and that nose. I never saw her cry the whole time she was with us. Dad said she was stuck up and wasn't really family. She married this Englishman after World War II. There's a photo of her on a ship waving with this white fella, his arm around her. For some reason, she didn't stay, which is strange. My family have always lived here. Nana used to say, just when all our men were coming back and we had our share to bury too, she upped and left us, the black princess sipping tea with the queen. Now I'm a Christian woman and I forgive her, but no more. No more talking of her. I drive Auntie Grace out to the cemetery on our way to the airport. She doesn't have much luggage. There's plenty of room in the back seat, but no one comes to see her off. I wait in the car while she goes out to the freshly turned soil of Nana's grave. She's there for such a long time, I think we're going to be late. Finally, she comes back to the car, opens the back door and removes her suitcase. She opens it, throwing the contents all over the ground. Everything, dragging the empty suitcase, the lid slapping her legs. She sits at the grave. The woman begins to fill the case with red earth from the grave. Crying, at last crying, the woman collects herself and places the suitcase on top of the disturbed grave. So I think there is a lot of symbolism that we can talk about in this particular scene, this idea of the grave and what that represents, that things are buried. So with the suitcase being pulled out of the grave, it's that idea that, you know, the memories and the stories that go with the photographs in this suitcase have also been buried. We also have this rift, if you like, in the family. So you have Nana, who sort of stayed here, but then her sister Grace, who went off to England after World War II. And there's that sense of resentment when we hear what Nana used to say, that, you know, just when all of the Australian boys and Indigenous boys were coming home, that Grace upped and left and, you know, went to have sipping tea with the Queen. And there's that sense that there is this disconnection, that because she has left, you know, she doesn't quite fit back into the family. She doesn't want to stay with them. She doesn't feel that sense of connection. But we see that changing right at the end when she actually empties her suitcase of everything that she's brought with her and starts filling it with the red earth, and that really powerful symbolism there that Indigenous people belong to the physical place where they are from. And it doesn't matter that they haven't lived there for decades, that, you know, their home is somewhere else, that they're still part of the earth and that the earth is sacred to them. The next scene is called Mugshot, and the stage directions say, delivered in the style of a court report with no hint of emotion. On 7th November 1993, Daniel Vok, together with Joseph Blair, Damien Bond, Lindsay Fisher, Archie Gray, Glenn Gray, Charles Riley, Edward Riley, and Daniel Weasel went to South Bank. After an altercation between Vok and an unknown person, the group left South Bank and travelled to Musgrave Park. Some alcohol was purchased at the Melbourne Hotel and consumed by the group in Musgrave Park. Whilst the group was in Musgrave Park, Constables Domro and Harris were patrolling the area surrounding the park. The group came to their attention, allegedly because they were abusive, and one of them exposed himself. After a period of time, the group left the park. Shortly after leaving the park, Weasel and Edward Riley left the group and proceeded along Russell Street to return to the Bain Street Hostel, whilst the balance of the group travelled down Edmonston Street with a view of going to the Oxford Street Hostel. This group was followed by Damro and Harris as they proceeded down Edmonston Street, across Melbourne Street, to a nearby street known as SEQEB Park on the corner of Boundary and Brereton Streets, West End. Before the group reached the location, Harris made a number of calls on the police radio seeking assistance, firstly from a Dutton Park car and thereafter from any car in the vicinity. A Dutton Park Crime Squad vehicle containing Acting Sergeant Symes and Senior Constable Bishop responded to the general call for assistance. The group entered SEQEB Park and Damro and Harris waited at or near a stop sign near the junction of Boundary and Edmonston Streets. As soon as Symes and Bishop arrived, they drove into Brereton Street, where both vehicles stopped near SEQEB Park. The woman stops abruptly, looks as if she's about to speak out, then resumes reading. The group dispersed. Vok ran but was intercepted and arrested by Symes. In the course of the arrest, Vok went to the ground. Bishop and Harris then pursued members of the group towards the hostel, leaving Symes and Damro with Vok. Shortly after the arrest of Vok, another Dutton Park vehicle containing Sergeant Crowley and Constable Crozier arrived at the scene. Crowley handcuffed Vok's hands behind his back. Crowley and Symes then left Damro and Crozier with Vok and drove down to the Oxford Street Hostel. At the hostel, there was a struggle between police and a group of youths. After remaining on the ground for some time, Damro and Crozier, Vok was then driven to the hostel. The woman finally breaks out. People called him Boonie. He was known as Boonie. She stops herself and continues to read tonelessly. By this time, other police had arrived at the scene, including Constable Carris, Constable Leyendeckers, Sergeant Whittaker, and Senior Constable Parker. After the incident at the hostel, police patrolled the area for at least 17 minutes looking for other alleged offenders. Two vehicles then travelled to the Brisbane City Watch House. In this section, the woman breaks away from the written word. This requires the actor to improvise the text in her own words. On Vok's arrival at the Watch House, his condition aroused immediate concern. When they looked closer, they saw that he wasn't breathing. He didn't have a pulse. The people at the Watch House didn't know what to do, so they called the ambulance. The ambulance got there and they had to pump needles into him. They were pounding his chest, giving mouth to mouth, whilst others stood back and watched. They took him to the Royal Brisbane Hospital, pounding and pushing his limp body. The woman returns to the written word. The resuscitation attempts were unsuccessful, and at 7:13 p.m. he was pronounced dead. So this scene speaks really strongly to this whole issue of Indigenous deaths in custody and the relationship between Indigenous people and the police. And we see from this police report that really there was, I mean, the Indigenous people weren't really doing anything that warranted the sort of response that they get. And this is very common. You don't have to look too far to have instances of this. Obviously, in this day and age, we can also draw comparisons with what's happening with the Black Lives Matter movement in the United States, and particularly the death of George Floyd and others who were killed unnecessarily by police officers. The next scene is called March, and the stage directions say, "The woman stands strong. Her body rocks with the rising pace of the march." The call went out. Faxes, mobile phones, leaflets, word of mouth, photocopiers working overtime. Flash, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. The news was out. Musgrave Park, 9 a.m., a peaceful march, a silent march. Thousands stretched out. "We're not fighting, we're grieving. I'm in a crowd. I'm in a crowd of people all walking. I'm in a crowd of people all walking along in silence. I'm in a crowd of people all walking along in silence. My dad, my brothers, and my sisters, and my nana. No one speaks, no one yells. Everyone just walks together. If you feel like fighting, if you feel like yelling, grab it in your hand and show your grief. Lift it up and show the world. I'm walking along and all I can hear is the shuffle of shoes. Everyone is too busy thinking about what it means to be here. Four helicopters circle the crowd." Declaiming news headlines. "Defiant Aboriginal March. Aboriginal March. Traffic stopper." "No one said that about fucking Santa parade the week before." "Hey, we're going to be on TV?" Frightened. "Hey, we're going to be on TV. Smile for the police camera." "We come from a long tradition of storytelling. If this the only way we get our story told. This huge gathering stops outside the police watch house in Herschel Street and we sit quiet. Roma Street crowd gather to watch. The family sing, dance and smoke out the spirit and the dancers play their clapsticks. The rhythm engulfs the crowd. The beat echoes round the buildings like if at last the song was coming up from the ground to swallow everything in revenge. The clapsticks ring out alone at first. I'm in the crowd and we all clap as we rise, as we walk. 6,000 people in rhythm pounding at the road, but we're not yelling, we're not fighting, we're grieving. A whistle rings out, the high-pitched ones you can only do if you hold your lips really tight. The clapsticks, the singing, the clapping, the pounding of our feet and the piercing ring of whistles. The woman stands, her arms raised defiantly. "Don't tell me we're not fighting. Don't tell me we don't fight most of our lives." So this scene is obviously a response to the mugshot, to that death in custody, and it's something that is obviously happening in pre-social media time. So it talks about faxes, mobile phones and leaflets. Obviously things like this would be organised very differently with social media. And it's really about this group of people that are gathering at the watch house where they're where this Indigenous boy or young man died to mourn him. And there is the ritual around that mourning of the, the smoking ceremony, the clapsticks, the idea that this is grief, that this isn't revenge, that this isn't something that's done in hatred, but it's something that's done in order to respect the dead. And this idea of this ongoing struggle, you know, the scene finishes with, "Don't tell me we're not fighting. Don't tell me we don't fight most of our lives." So that notion that it is a constant struggle, this isn't something that just happens on particular days or particular occasions, but for Indigenous people, every day is part of that ongoing struggle. The next scene is called Bargaining. And the stage directions say, "The sound of hammering. The woman slams a nail through two pieces of wood. She stands and carries the wooden cross over to the grave. As she drives it into the red earth, the words 'for sale' are relieved. What is it worth?" So this scene references another really important issue when we're talking about Indigenous rights in Australia, and that is this notion of native title and the Mabo land claim. I think the fact that the for sale sign is actually being hammered into that same spot that is the grave is also quite symbolic. And this notion that, you know, was Australia ever for sale? Was it ever land that could be claimed by someone else? The next scene is called Home Story, and the stage directions say, "The woman takes several handfuls of red earth from the grave, making a large pile on the floor. Now I want to tell you a story. I'll tell you how it was told to me. Now, it's very complex. I get it wrong sometimes. I'm no expert, but I'll try to explain it the best way I can. So you'll have to stay with me. It's all got to do with family, culture, and language and stuff. Are you with me? This pile here is the land, the source, the spirit, the core of everything. Are you with me on that? The woman makes a circle around the pile. And this one here is about culture, family, song, tradition, dance. Have you got that? Then came the children. Everyone has their place. Now this is where it gets complicated, so you'll have to stay with me. The woman makes 8 smaller piles around the larger pile within the circle. You always have to marry within your own skin. If I was part of this pile here, that would mean this pile would be my mother because you always follow the line of the mother. And this pile could be my father or this one, which makes this one and this one here my grandparents and cousins. Now, if I was to marry, I couldn't marry from the same pile because they would be my brothers and sisters. But I could marry this pile here because they're my cousins, which makes this pile my children because you can always follow the line of the woman. Are you with me? I'll explain that again. This mob and this mob can marry because they're grandparents and cousins. You can't marry this mob because they're your brothers and sisters. And you can't marry this mob or this mob because they're your children. Because you always follow the line of the woman. You can't marry this one, or this one, because that's like marrying your father. The only ones I could marry are, wait a minute, this mob and this mob can marry because they're grandparents and cousins. You can't marry this mob because they're your brothers and sisters. And you can't marry this mob or this mob because they're your children. Because you always follow the line of the woman. You can't marry this one, or this one, because that's like marrying your father. The only ones I could marry are this mob or this mob. Are you with me? The woman gathers up the smaller piles and relocates them on the white fringe that defines the black performing area. Now imagine when the children are taken away from this. Are you with me? The woman flays her arms through the remaining large pile and circle, destroying it. So this is quite a visual scene. So it's something that you probably need to maybe go back and listen to again. And just the message underpinning this is obviously this notion of family structures and how important family and family connections and the relationships between different branches of a family tree were, and how all of those interconnections are managed in Indigenous culture, and this idea of marrying within your own skin. So it also suggests that Indigenous culture is a matriarchal society, a matriarchal culture, because it keeps talking about following the line of the woman. And then it talks about this, you know, imagining what happens when the children are taken away. So again, going back to that notion of the stolen generation and how that just completely destroyed all of the ways in which these societies and family groupings were organized, because an entire generation was removed. The next scene is called Story of a Brother, and the stage directions say, the sound of laughter, the woman comes forward to tell her story. I have a brother. He's 21 years old. This one night he was walking down the mall with 2 of his mates, pissed as. They were walking along, and you know in the mall, all those little cameras you see with the big bug eyes, they were watching them. True. They wanted one of my brother's friends, I don't know why, in connection to something or to question him because some other black kid had done something wrong. You know how we all look alike? And so they came down to get him. My brother said, you can't take him away. You've got no right. They basically said they did have the right, and they grabbed my brother's friend. Now this fella, my brother, he's not the smartest of men. And when he's on the charge, the woman demonstrates, he can be a little clumsy. He thought, this fella's done nothing wrong. So with his sense of justice and him sticking up for his bungies, he pushed the police officer, and the police officer pushed back. So he pushed again. I said, leave him alone. Another police officer fairly lifted him onto the ground, his arm at his back, him kicking and swearing, handcuffs, back in the car. They charged him. No good, that fella. Shame. They charged him with, as a magistrate, assault or obstructing the course of justice, or something. He was fined $1,000 and put on a 2-month probation. It wasn't that serious. But when Dad went to pick him up from the watch house in the middle of the night, the shame was palpable. Because of the shame, my brother just buggled around the house, chucked in his job, couldn't get the dole, couldn't pay his fine, had to front court. When the dole did come in, he was too slack with his diary, lost it, borrowed money from Mum and Dad, which made him even more dependent and embarrassed. To cope, he went out all night with his mates, got pissed, broke his probation, got another fine, 3rd strike. This is how it starts, the cycle, this cycle. I know it happens. I know it can happen to anyone. But in our family, to be shamed out like that eats your spirit, your life. We've seen it before. We've seen it too many times. Cousins going in and then you get that call. My brother fronts court in 2 weeks and the family's still wondering what's going to happen. So this scene talks about this cycle. It references this cycle of Indigenous people in the justice system and how when they are arrested and charged with something relatively minor, how it just spirals out of control and becomes this sort of never-ending cycle of shame and dependence and a lack of self-worth that they can't seem to escape from. The next scene is called Gallery of Sorrow, and the stage directions say, a collection of images appears depicting the phrases of Aboriginal history, dreaming, invasion, genocide, protection, assimilation, self-determination, and reconciliation. So these are the phases of Indigenous history, and obviously these seven phases, and that links back to the title of the story, The Seven Stages of Grieving. So really important to go back and reflect on that phase of dreaming of Aboriginal history. So that's looking at the time before the arrival of the First Fleet, the invasion phase, so that period of the arrival, that first interactions between Indigenous Australians and white settlers, the genocide, so obviously the killing of Indigenous Australians, the protection policies of the late 1800s and early 1900s where Aboriginal children were taken away from their parents, that period of assimilation, which was sort of that next period where Aboriginal people were forcibly assimilated into white culture, and now this emerging period of self-determination where Aboriginal people have found a voice and representation and there is a greater awareness of the need to look at Indigenous rights. And then finally that phase of reconciliation, which you can argue we still probably haven't really entered. The next scene is called Suitcase Opening, and the stage direction says, the woman paints herself as if preparing for war. Though her movements are restricted, her voice assails the audience with a sense of all-encompassing sorrow. She takes the suitcase, opens it, throwing the red earth and family photos it contains all over the floor. The woman grieves over the photographs. The woman leaves. Images of landscape interweave with family portraits, creating a tapestry of land and people. Music fills the space. There is a feeling of catharsis and release. So this scene again talks about that really important connection between Indigenous people and the land and this sense that the two are very much united. You can't separate Indigenous people from the land from which they come. The next scene is called Rec Con Silly Nation Poem. And the stage direction says, the woman returns to the performing area cleansed, fresh. Written in childlike script are the words Rec Con, silly, nation are projected. The boats are ready for departure. If you don't want to stay, a wreck on arrival, a changing flag, a con, a silly pride for sale. My nation knows my identity. A son, a land, a people, travelling, what a mess. So obviously this is a play on words with the notion of reconciliation and that being broken down to the words wreck, con, silly and nation, and what each of those means in relation to the way Indigenous people view what has happened to them since the arrival of the First Fleet. The next scene is called Everything Has Its Time, and the stage directions say, the woman addresses the audience. The space is full of words. Rec, con, silly, nation. Some people write it like this. Rec, con, silly, nation. What's the use of having a word if we don't think and talk about it? In the end, it isn't something you read or write that changes your life. It's something you do. The woman retrieves the suitcase. The word reconciliation is packed into it. The woman jocks the suitcase. Everything has its time. Everything has its time. So there is a suggestion in this scene that it is time for reconciliation and that now needs to be the imperative in order to repair all of this damage that has happened in the past. The next scene is called Plea, and the stage direction says, the woman carries the suitcase with her as she approaches the audience. You know, there's this grieving for our land, our families, our cultures. But we've been taught to cry quietly, where only our eyes betray us with tears. But now we can no longer wait. I'm scared, my heart is hardening. I'm so full and know my capacity for grief. I fear I can no longer grieve. What can I do? These are my stories. These are my people's stories. They need to be told. The woman places the suitcase down at the feet of the audience. So I think in this scene there's a real transfer of responsibility almost from the one woman actor and from the narrative that we've seen play out on the stage back to the audience, that it is now up to the way people respond to what they have seen in front of them with this play. The final scene of the play is called Walking Across Bridges. When we get to North Sydney Station, it hits me. The train stops and the doors open and everyone is moving. You get onto the platform and you realise it's packed, slowly moving up the stairs and through the turnstiles and more trains coming. And I'm on my phone to my friends saying they've got to get down here. Something's going off. It takes us 40 minutes to get to the street. I mean, they've stopped taking the tickets. They've turned off the gate machines and just letting people through. And as we walk down the hill and you see the bridge and suddenly you can see how many people there are walking across the bridge. And I get that tingle. I get that tingle now just talking about it. I mean, there's so many people. I'm walking across the bridge, and if you look from a distance, it's like a colourful snake, like a rainbow serpent. In the middle of the bridge, I stop, and there's an old auntie. She's staring up through the bridge, and she's crying. Not the kind of crying you do at funerals. This is different. I look up, and I can see the flag flying on the bridge, red, black, and yellow. They've written sorry. They've written sorry across the sky. They've said over 250,000 people walked that day, and then more in Melbourne, Brisbane, Adelaide, all around the country. Like a song, it caught on, walking across bridges. Who would have thought, eh? I guess we can't go back now. So this final scene talks about the reconciliation march that took place in Sydney and the fact that one of the things that happened on that day with, you know, 250,000 people walking across Sydney Harbour Bridge was that there was a sky writer, a sort of a plane in the sky that wrote the word sorry, and that's what this older Indigenous woman is looking at as she's walking across the bridge. And the play finishes then with that final statement, I guess we can't go back now. So this notion that, you know, that was a real pivotal moment in the history of reconciliation in Australia, and that now things just have to move forward at whatever pace that is, but that it's not possible to go back to a time before that, that things have to keep moving forward.